to the 138th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Happy 58th birthday to Alex Stewart. At times during his England career, Stewart captained, kept and opened the batting. Welcome to the podcast that reckons you've got to let someone else have a go.
Alex Stewart approaching his 60th birthday makes me feel pretty old, I have to say. I grew up watching Alex Stewart do all of those things, captaining, keeping and opening the batting. And just as he was a multi-talented cricketer, I want to say that we're a multi-talented podcast, but let's say a multifaceted podcast, as ever on Reverse Swept Radio. We are going to be diving back into some cricket history. Andy's got a fascinating feature on a cricketing hoax from the 1930s. We're going to be reviewing a book, Cricket Country, by Prashant Kadambi. And we're going to kick off, as we always do, with what has caught our eye in the world of cricket since we last recorded the podcast. Andy, what have you been looking at?
So today was the opening day of the county championship season, which was, in true kind of English fashion, was going ahead despite it being freezing. And the return of the county championship season means the return of the BBC's merry band of county cricket commentators. Now, unlike the extensive squads that Test Match Special has, the county commentators tend to work in pairs, so you've got a commentator attached to each team, which means that over the course of a day, and certainly over the course of a game or a season, you get to know them very well indeed. These are pros. They know the game and they know their counties inside out. But I do really like the fact that, perhaps in contrast to TMS, they allow themselves to show the enthusiasm of fans a bit. There is also a rather bizarre feature of the commentary that always catches me out, which is that, again, unlike TMS, there is no lunch show or tea show because, you know, these poor commentators need a break. You know, they've been going for hours. They need an actual tea break. So I will always do this thing where I leave the commentary running, start doing something else, and then totally forget that it's there. And then this disembodied voice will launch out and say, "And welcome at Lord's to the evening session," and it will always give me a heart attack. And that happened today, and I thought, the cricket season is back.
It's actually quite an interesting, in terms of radio making, the fact that on TMS you have, you know, a whole raft of producers and special features that are, you know, are pre-recorded and ready to go, whereas in these games it literally is just two people with microphones with the game in front of them, and that's all they have got. And it takes a particular kind of skill and craft to be able to do that and to be able to kind of carry the commentary as well.
I think the endurance is remarkable. I mean, I think, you know, the way they go without pause is quite something. And I often think there's an interesting thing from a sort of dynamics point of view, because, as I said, you know, you'll have the different commentators attached to the different counties, and they'll generally only work together at the time those counties are playing each other. So they don't perhaps have the way you would build up a kind of rapport in the way some others, some other commentary teams might do. But huge credit to them, huge credit to the BBC and others for their kind of ongoing support. The listenership figures they continue to get are vast. So
are they interesting? Really, I've often wondered. So they actually publish those listenership. There's a way of sort
they
of
do.
Them.
I've sort of seen them. It's interesting. I don't know how systematically they're published, but I've seen them from time to time, and it's always really impressive. Which it's this funny thing about county cricket that, however much it's joke at the start of the season to publish the picture of the empty ground,
the one man and his dog. Yeah.
Exactly. There do appear to be an awful lot of people paying attention. Now, you've been reflecting. You were talking about feeling old on Alex Stewart's birthday.
Yes.
You've been reflecting on the passage of time through a fine, fine cricket team.
Yeah, so since I arrived in Australia 7.5 years ago, I think, one of the constants in my life, I suppose, has been playing for my Sunday work team, the ABC team. And it's a team that's taken on a few manifestations over the years, but the core of players has remained the same. And when I started, we were a team of motley 20-somethings, and our sort of appearance was true to that. Every single game, there are a couple of players who turned up definitely not having been to bed, smelling a bit funny, whose pupils were, you know, bigger than a cricket ball. But yet we all seemed to have kind of boundless energies. None of us really got injured along the way. And now, nearly 8 years on, I had a chance to reflect on how much things had changed when we were playing in our league semi-final just last weekend. And whilst all the players were the same, there were four children and a whole group of wives cheering from the boundary. And the only reason that anyone had been staying up the night before was to change a nappy. And it just made me reflect on the fact that we don't actually, in a way, we don't know each other all that well. We don't see each other often outside the weekly game of cricket, and when we do, often the conversation is mostly about cricketing things. But yet there is something wonderful about the ritual of meeting every week and whatever else is going on in our lives. And there's been a lot of, you know, sort of personal change for people, whether it's having babies or other things during that period. There's just this absolute rhythm that comes with meeting up every week and playing cricket together.
This might exist, but I've often thought this would be wonderful for a novel, you know, a kind of
a story of a team through time.
Exactly. They're kind of like linking the characters, keeping them going. Maybe someone has done it, but I think it'd be a wonderful basis for a novel. What do you think the team's secret is? Because there are plenty of teams who go through the kind of progression you're talking about. I mean, I think it is a pretty classic feature, a lot of teams that, you know, particularly once marriage and kids come onto the scene, teams can splinter a bit. How have you managed to keep things together?
That is a really interesting question. And if I knew the answer to that, I would probably be a rich man. One of the things I've always observed, compared to a lot of the teams that we play against, who often, where often you sense an underlying, resentment is maybe too strong a word, but where teams are competitive, sometimes actually things fray at the edges when you have people who don't kind of perform properly. And we are proudly a team of kind of no hope. It's like we do, you know, we play properly and we show up and we try, but we lose more regularly than we win. And no one really cares. It's just that nice dynamic where we all we're all there to celebrate each other's achievements. But if someone gets out for, you know, a duck playing a horrible shot, everyone will say bad luck. It's got nothing to do with luck. You played a horrible shot first ball. It was a yorker and you tried to hit it over cow court. It had nothing to do with luck. It was sheer incompetence. But none of us really care about that. And I think it's the reason that we're there is not because we're all aspiring cricketers who care about winning. It's about something very, you know, kind of very different to that. And I think that's what has meant that there's a kind of common bond within the team.
Well, here's to 8 more years.
From the archives, and in this episode of Reverse Swept Radio, Andy is telling us about a hoax and a war, Peter Smith's 13-year wait for Test cricket.
It's August the 11th, 1933. It's a Friday evening, and we're in Chelmsford. Essex leg spinner Peter Smith is enjoying an evening at the cinema, and, you know, why not? He's worked hard. A message comes up on the screen to say he's required outside, where his excited father meets him, holding a telegram. Smith has been called up as injury cover to play the third test against the West Indies, beginning the following morning at the Oval. A fairly surprised Smith rings up Essex, who confirmed that they've received the telegram from the MCC. It was a surprise. This is a strong England team, but it wasn't totally out of the blue. Smith was just 24, but he was into his fourth season with Essex and going really well, almost up to 100 wickets for the season. This was a pretty extraordinary transformation for a man who only 4 years earlier had been on the verge of moving for a new life in Africa with the Rhodesian Mounted Police, which I think says everything you need to know about how he rated his cricketing prospects.
I suppose it was a different world as well, in the sense that nowadays, if you are going to get into the England side, you're part of a development team and then you're put into a fast-tracked something supercharged channel or whatever they call it, and you go off to Loughborough to do blah de blah. Whereas actually selection worked much differently then. You know, it was the county game took precedence and the England side was collected from a group of county cricketers, so it was just being plucked out of, you know, the county game. Here you go, you've got your test test cap. So, you know, as you say, it probably wouldn't have been totally unusual. I mean, what is unusual is you read about people, you know, reading about their selection in the newspaper or, you know, finding out about it from their cleaning lady. This one of getting it kind of flashed up on the cinema screen is a wonderful way of starting that whole journey. So, so he's got the telegram and he's getting excited about playing for England.
Indeed, I tried to fact check this point about could you get things flashed up in a cinema screen.
Well, indeed, I wondered that.
Because it seemed bizarre to me, but it's...
This feels like a rabbit hole, by the way.
It does. So let's leave 1930s cinemas and instead join Peter Smith on the early train to London. Smith gets to the Oval and he asks Bob Wyatt, who was England's captain, whether he was in the final 11 or not. Wyatt confesses that he hadn't expected to see Smith. And I love this next bit because it's the most English approach to an awkward situation. Wyatt had seen Smith in the changing room, but decided to say nothing. which is obviously the way you deal with something like this. A little digging was undertaken and it transpired that the telegram that had gone to Essex had not in fact come from the MCC. Understandably, huge sympathy for Smith. He spent the day at the test as a guest of what was then the Board of Control, and the MCC secretary, a man called William Findlay, assured him that he would get into the team one day.
On the basis that, out of sympathy, we will give you a cap one day, or assured him, we think you're a promising young player, and I'm sure you've got a bright future for England.
I would assume the latter. I mean, yeah. I think, frankly, what choice do you have? I mean, you've got to say something nice, haven't you, in a situation like that. Yeah. So Bob Wyatt would later write, "The poor fellow, he had been made the victim of a cruel hoax. I have never known such a dirty trick to be played on a cricketer before." So how might this hoax have worked? If you wanted to send a telegram, you had to go to a post office. The staff tapped the message into a telegraph machine. The message was received at the destination post office, where it was either printed out or rewritten by hand. A delivery boy then cycles to deliver it. What strikes me about this whole process, aside from it being an almighty nuisance and an awful lot of work for everyone involved, was that a hoax seems very easy to carry out. There doesn't seem to have been any need for proof of identity. So I don't really see what was to stop me.
And presumably it's like sending a letter in the sense that you just sign it off whoever you sign it off as. It's not like an email that comes from an email address, which, you know, you need to make look legitimate, that you could just go into a post office and say, "Hello, I'm from the MCC, you're getting called up." And even if there was a kind of post stamp from that post office, you wouldn't necessarily think to check out whether that post office was the one that the MCC used necessarily. So presumably it was pretty easy to just send a telegram on someone else's behalf.
I think you're right that probably the only way you could catch it out is to say, "Well, oh, this is odd. I've got this telegram from the MCC that appears to have been sent from Lancashire." You know, that's probably about as good as you're going to get. But there appears to have been no serious attempt to discover who had sent the telegram.
Yeah, who did send it? Do we know?
Well, we don't. And this is what seems odd about it, because if it was done as a sort of practical joke, you would think you would own up, wouldn't you?
Yep.
Unless perhaps you see how out of hand your practical joke got.
Has actually got, yeah.
Right, and you sort of regretted it. Smith is an odd target. I mean, he hadn't offended anyone. He was a youngster making his way in the game. And to his credit, he went back to Essex, took his 100th wicket for the season in the very next game and got on with life. We fast forward 6 years, and it's August 1939, and the MCC named their squad for an upcoming tour of India. The announcement in itself is pretty surprising, given that war seemed increasingly inevitable by this point. At this time, England would generally send a slightly weaker team abroad for any tour that wasn't Australia or South Africa, and the majority of the biggest names weren't in this squad. Smith was there, and it was no hoax. He had done well at Essex, but had still never played for England by this point. I think we'll never know how much Smith got his hopes up for this tour. I mean, he would have read the news the same as anyone else in August 1939. He'd have seen what was largely predicted. Within a month, war had been declared on Germany. The tour was officially cancelled. Smith would enlist and go on to serve in Egypt.
You also wonder, when he did get called up for that tour, whether he might have just gone, "Oh, it's another hoax." And then, you know, to what extent do you ever believe anything again when you've got your hopes up as a young guy for getting called up? How far do you ever? But it's certainly a cruel moment when he does finally make the team and Hitler scuppers him.
It must leave you with a constant skepticism. You're not going to believe it until you are on the field. And he did finally get there. So we fast forward 7 years, and it's August 1946. It's 13 years now since that hoax telegram, and a 37-year-old Peter Smith, so no longer the young leg spinner, makes his debut for England against India at the Oval. So back where it all began. In a rain-affected game, he takes 1 for 58, and with 3 wickets over the 4 test matches that he got, his test career was modest, but I would imagine that after the disappointments, it was a great joy to have any test career at all. It is worth noting, though, that Smith does not deserve to be remembered as a hoax victim. He earned a couple of pretty extraordinary places in the record books. So to this day, no one has taken more first-class wickets for Essex than him. And perhaps more entertainingly, no number 11 in a first-class game has bettered his innings of 163. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading Cricket Country by Prashant Kidambi. It was published in 2019, and Kidambi is an associate professor of colonial urban history at the University of Leicester. Cricket Country is the story of the first all-India cricket tour of Great Britain and Ireland. Now, by 1911, lots of other teams had made it to England on tour. Why did it take this long to get an India team out there?
Kidambi spends about the first third of the book describing the failed attempts to get a cricket tour happening to England, and they don't happen for a number of reasons, including a 1904 tour that falls apart because there's disagreement over the kind of ethnic makeup of the team, and that cricket is seen as being such a significant part of Indian identity that it's always agonized over how to actually make a team that represents all of India. Ditto the relationship between India and England at the time as the kind of colonizers and the colonized, again, puts all this kind of heat behind it, I suppose. So there are a number of failed attempts until they finally get to the 1911 tour and finally get that one off the ground.
And I think when they get there, it goes very poorly for a while. And one of the reasons for this is that actually information and development of the game just didn't quite travel in a uniform way at this point. So today, if someone innovates, you know, it's on YouTube by tomorrow and other teams can copy, etc. But swing bowling, for example, was something that was genuinely new to the Indian team. It hadn't been practiced in the same way and was not surprisingly quite a thing to adjust for. The other thing was the googly, which, again, despite the Indian team having some very talented slow bowlers, the googly, which was, I think, reasonably new by 1911, but was having a not insignificant impact.
Yeah, you forget in a kind of globalised world that things could happen in England that were just never seen in India around the game. One of the pieces of context that Kidambi puts around the game is the fact around that summer, it's the fact that it was incredibly hot. In England, it was a record-breaking temperatures in England that summer, and while you might assume that that would be in favour of the Indians, who would be more used to that kind of weather, that actually because it was very humid, it really helped the swing bowling, and that the Indian batsmen really kind of failed against that. But there was one brilliant Indian bowler though.
Yes, there was Palwankar Ballu, who I think for all the ups and downs of the Indian team received rave reviews across the tour. There's an interesting story about him specifically in that he was one of the few members of the Indian team who was considered from the untouchable caste, which in himself made him quite a groundbreaking figure. His brilliant bowling performance against Leicestershire led the Star newspaper to declare a hullabaloo. So there you go.
Classic. Even headline writing was obviously in its prime at the time. The other thing that's interesting about this tour, and Kidambi provides a lot of context around it, is that actually touring England was a really sort of loaded thing for these Indian cricketers. It wasn't just about going, playing a few games and coming away again, you know, going, sitting in your hotel room. It was a coronation summer, so all of that was whichever king it was, George the something, who was being crowned at the time. My royal history is not up to scratch. So there was all of that going on. There were also, and Kidambi spent a lot of time describing it, there were also other kind of sporting spectacles happening at the time. But you suddenly realise that for these Indian cricketers, they really would have felt a huge weight of expectation around it. And one of the great, one of the kind of anecdotes I enjoyed was the fact that the kind of Barmy Army idea was born on this tour, the idea of how you have a travelling group of supporters that comes with the team. But in this case, it was a group of high-caste vegetarian Hindus, and there's this wonderful advertisement that's recreated in the book talking about the food. If you join up, if you're of appropriate social standard to join up, that they were hiring all of the best vegetarian chefs to go with this group to accompany them on the voyage, so that when they went over to England, the land of, you know, boiled mutton, that they could have, you know, decent food along the way. So a little bit different from the way the Barmy Army operates, I dare say, but still this great indication of the kind of social expectation that sat around this tour from an Indian perspective.
So one of the main characters of the story of the first All India tour is actually someone who never went, and he was someone who everyone was desperate to go. So this is the great Ranjit Singhji, often known just as Ranji. There was an absolute desperation to get him involved. Much loved in England, much respected. But it was a problem for him because actually he had already played for England. And there was a concern, certainly personally, but more broadly, that being seen to play for India would kind of undermine his claim at English nationality. And I think in this, you see, I guess, a lot of debates that have happened in more recent times about whether someone is, you know, English enough to represent England. There was also the not insignificant matter that he was involved in a long-standing quest for the Nawanaga throne, which you could see was a fairly considerable distraction.
Yeah, it was a really interesting kind of portrait of Ranji, who I don't actually know all that much about, but actually seeing him through that lens of the person who wants to, as you say, preserve his claim to English nationality, but then also just this kind of real sort of self-interest around inheriting this throne, which is just absolutely his key drivers, and sort of cricket is a means to an end in both of those regards. The person who ends up being the captain of the team is a guy called Bhupinder Singh, and there are some fascinating stories behind how he comes to be the captain. He's very much not the first choice. He's, I think, seen as being a bit of a sort of liability. He's sort of the errant younger son, kind of, and we don't quite hear what it is, but we just get kind of allusions to sort of bad behaviour along the way. He's actually the person who probably should have been picked to be captain when Ranji couldn't do it was a guy called Major Mystery, who was actually the private secretary of Bhupinder Singh, the Maharaja of Patiala. There's thinking that actually Bhupinder Singh was asked to be captain precisely so that Major Mystery could come on the tour, because in the past, Mystery had been barred from coming because of his official duty. So they thought, well, if we bring his boss on the tour, then surely he has to come as well. Then Singh actually turns... takes up the captaincy, despite the fact that very shortly before, they tried to persuade him to go on an educational trip around India to kind of improve his behaviour. But he said, no, I need to be at home with my new wife. But then there's another offer that comes in to go on a cricket tour of England, and he just leaps at the opportunity and goes, yeah, sure, of course I'll be there. And the same kind of consideration seems to go out of the window.
I think it's fascinating as a portrait of the era, in that Bhupinder Singh is a Maharaja, you know, a prince of a huge domain in India. And yet he's still having to get permission from the Raj authorities to actually go to England. And I think this book is constantly centred on how those colonial influences affected the Indian team and their reception. It's a book that ranges broadly, and I think what some people will find as useful context, other people will find as distraction. I must confess that I found myself reading a passage about other Indian sportsmen in England at the time of the tour, and found myself thinking, God, is this strictly necessary? And then found myself very much enjoying it. So sometimes something will begin as a distraction and then become an enjoyable anecdote.
Yeah, there was an interesting anecdote about a lot of boxers who appear, and boxing was obviously a big ticket sport at the time. And there's this Indian boxer who I'm just very curious about his internal economy, because apparently he consumed every day he consumed broth extracted from meat and bones, as well as 20 liters of milk, half a liter of clarified butter, 3/4 of a kilogram of butter, and 4 kilograms of fruit per day. I would not have liked to have lived with that guy. But sometimes Kadambi's eye for detail can be incredible as well, in terms of being able to glean information from, you know, historical very detailed historical notes. You notice something about the gate receipts.
Well, he picks up a financial statement from the tour, which allows him to kind of make estimates of all the attendances, which is a very ingenious way of kind of working backwards from a set of figures. It also gives you quite an insight into how the arrangements just work. The fact that some teams would give the Indians a guaranteed sum of money, the others would make it a split based on how many people turned up, which I think is quite a fun introduction to just these were the economics of the time. 50 quid was a good return for the India team for a single game, which was, I think you have to treat these calculations with some caution, but I think is estimated as roughly £6,000 in today's money. And in the end, the tour made a profit, which I think is a not insignificant achievement, although they worked hard for that. It was a book on a topic that was new to both of us. I mean, what would you say for someone who is looking at this and thinking whether this was kind of too esoteric a topic for them? Should they give it a go?
Absolutely. It's a book that is, yes, it's centered around this specific tour, but it's about so much more than that. It's about India and the development of India in the 19th century. It's about English politics at the beginning of the 20th century. It's an absolutely fascinating read. I kind of wish that I had had more time to really sit and enjoy it, and it's definitely something that I will, a book that I will return to, I think, and read again. There's so much detail and richness in it. So don't expect it just to be a simple account of a few cricket matches. You'll be frustrated if you do have that expectation, but do expect it to be an absolutely fascinating read about a whole lot of different worlds.
That was the 138th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. As ever, if you enjoyed the podcast, do leave us a review on iTunes. Helps other people to find us. And as ever, get in touch with us on Twitter @ReverseSwept.